You're listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 95. This minute begins with Vickers stroking Waylon's hand, and ends with David being a big liar and saying, "Want," not a concept I'm familiar with. In a way, Meredith's false affection here is more disturbing than if she had been aggressive or even violent towards Waylon. She's toying with him, asserting her dominance. She's young and strong, he is old and frail, and you can see that so clearly here. She's putting him back in his place. When she says father in this scene, I think this is the first time that's ever been made clear to us. But I almost missed it because I'm so familiar with this movie. I don't remember if that was that much of a shocking revelation when I first watched it. I think the sibling rivalry between Vickers and David certainly sells the idea that things are very personal for her anyway. We then cut to Shaw getting ready. She wears only the compression undersuit. David enters the room. It's the, armory, if you will. You know, all the spacesuits are kept there and the weapons and what have you. You saw everyone getting ready in there at the beginning of the film. And David is fully suited up, so he's got the outer blue EVA suit on. Even now, he's following protocol. It might just be for show, but as I've previously argued, he wears the full suit as a backup for his human crew members. That said, we see it is clearly possible to go out of the environment in only the compression suit.
What's the significance? I don't know!
As he speaks with Shaw, David is barely containing his true feelings.
I didn't think you had it in you. Sorry. Poor choice of words. Extraordinary survival instincts, Elizabeth.
Since about the ultrasound scene, he's dropped all pretenses around Shaw, although in that scene he was still playing in a grey area. You were left wondering what he meant by watching her dreams. Now he's outright contemptuous and sarcastic. It is such a Mean Girls moment. I can absolutely see Regina George saying David's dialogue here. You know, oops, poor choice of words. And he is basically saying, "Oh my god, I love your skirt," but thinking that is the ugliest skirt I've ever seen. And much like how Katie and Regina have this weird toxic relationship where you're not sure what Regina wants from her friends, but she clearly wants them around regardless, David is very much the same with Shaw. I can't believe there is an easy parallel between Mean Girls and Prometheus, but here we are. Mean Girls is a legitimately good movie, though. I believe David is expressing himself in what might be termed a feminine way. He's very catty. That is something fascinating about David, his androgyny. And I haven't discussed it in a long time. I only touched on the physical attributes, though. To recap, of course, Fassbender himself is an alpha Chad, but he was styled in an androgynous way in Prometheus. He was quite slender at the time, and they dressed him like David Bowie and bleached his hair and did all of that. But he has the same build and haircut in X-Men First Class, so styling plays a part, but it's really the mannerisms that sell that androgynous quality. It's very subtly played. It never comes across as overtly feminine or masculine, gay or straight. He instead sits in this uncanny valley of gender presentation. As if, I suppose, gender is meaningless to him and it is simply a role he was assigned. I don't think I've ever seen that explored in fiction that much, how androids regard their own gender. In Star Trek, Data sometimes says things like, "I'm not actually a man, just made in the image of one," and he's aware of how that determines how people respond to him. David is also capable of playing around with these gender attributes. How he relates to others and expresses himself could also be described as feminine. That Mean Girls reference wasn't a coincidence. Heterosexual men don't tend to be manipulative or duplicitous in conflict. They are direct. Maybe it's just name-calling and bickering, or it might present itself in aggression or even violence. This is, of course, not taking conflict-avoidant people into account, because David is clearly not that. It's not really worth considering here. Girls, especially as teenagers, form a complex social hierarchy and interpersonal relationships. It becomes very political, complete with the need to pick allegiances. They will pretend to be friends with someone only to betray them when they've gotten what they needed or when convenient. This is what reality TV is made of. Actually, a really good example of gender differences is a show called Girls and Boys Alone. It was this short British series, it's all on YouTube now, where a group of boys live in a house without adults, and a group of girls do the same separately. It clearly demonstrates a lot about the differences in social and emotional development in girls and boys of equal age. I think when we reach adulthood, these differences become less defined, and I can't rightly say why. Maybe we are less confined to cultural barriers, including gender, or everyone has matured. They do say that girls mature faster than boys, and there seems to be some scientific evidence for that. So it could be a case that, well, a 30-year-old man and a 30-year-old woman are emotionally of comparable levels. The thing is, David cannot express himself in a masculine way even if he wanted to. He can't express himself in a direct way. Apparently not even now, even though he's getting close to dropping the facade of obedience. So he's been forced to learn to be duplicitous, to be passive-aggressive. In Covenant, he further plays with his androgyny. He's free to express himself however he pleases, and the result is melodramatic. There are aspects that are more camp or more feminine, and yet he also weaponizes his masculinity, notably when he displays his physical strength and overpowers Daniels and attempts to molest her, but also just in the way he walks. This is actually a Fassbender trait. His natural walking gait is pelvis first, which is something I remember learning about in high school drama class. But it's also really useful to me as an illustrator. Everyone leads with a different part of their body when they walk. It might be head first, or chest, or pelvis. If someone is coming at your knees or elbows first, you've either found yourself in Cirque du Soleil or The Grudge. But try switching your lead point for yourself. You will instantly notice a change in the way you walk and the way you feel. So, you know, if you've got poor posture and you are walking head first, and you go from that to chest first, you open up your airways, you're taking in more of your surroundings. It's sort of that project what you want to be or how you want to feel. It very much changes something inside of you. It's kind of the same thing as enclothed cognition, where if someone is wearing a particular uniform, they feel more qualified to take on that role. As David and as Walter, Fassbender walks in a very upright, rigid posture. But after David has been alone for years, you see that pelvis first gait, which is masculine, but he can also use that to seem threatening or predatory. It's not that David is merely imitating masculine or feminine traits. I think for the most part, they embody who he really is and what he's experiencing in that moment. We can debate whether or not it is nature or nurture. When he is first activated, he is entirely neutral. Am I discovering more depths to Fassbender's performance, or have I been thinking about these movies way too long? You decide. I think what fascinates me about androgyny is how subjective it is, culturally and personally, and how it can be expressed in a number of ways. Complete gender neutrality is a difficult thing to accomplish, but I'm always amazed when I see someone I genuinely can't identify immediately. Shaw asks,
"What happens when Waylon is not around to program you anymore?"
"I suppose I'd be free."
"You want that?"
"Want? Not a concept I'm familiar with."
I don't know, is that how that works? I guess we've discovered Waylon apparently doesn't plan ahead, so maybe on his death, David really can just do whatever the hell he wants. He doesn't have any other protocols? Listen to humans? No. No, nothing at all. Okay. The concept of freedom and desire would indeed be unknown to real AI. It only wants to do what it was created to do. It doesn't experience boredom, it doesn't get tired, it can't die. It has none of the motivations that make humans want to express themselves and seek new and novel experiences. However, David isn't just an AI. Walter is just an AI. You could tell him to stare at a wall all day and he would do it. But David is very much a person. I don't know if all David models are like him. I think it's more likely he is unique. Waylon wanted to create an artificial man, and then he decided to make him a servant. Deadly combination. Many AI specialists do speak about the notion that you might not even be able to have artificial intelligence without a body, without a way of sensing the world and having that feedback. It's a very complex system, the way our minds work, in that the conscious, the cognitive experience emerges from the physical and biological. So everything we experience arises from what the body is experiencing. So emotion and thoughts. It's all response to stimulus. And so the real difficulty with creating, well, not an artificial intelligence, specifically an artificial consciousness. If we were to try to make someone or something like David, he would absolutely need to have a physical body. That's the going consensus right now. There's no way you can just make that in a virtual system unless you created a person living in a virtual world who didn't realize their world was the Matrix, essentially. Basically, HAL isn't the way to go. Expanding on what I said last minute about classic stories, that it's harder for modern audiences to connect with them, I've been giving more thought to that, and it occurs to me how human culture is collective. I mean, that's a big part of my philosophy, I think. Everyone is put on this earth just to further our collective culture just a little bit. You know, and thousands, millions, billions of lives will push us to futures we can't even imagine yet. But this also applies to our storytelling. We build upon existing concepts, and in this way, those older ideas never die. They evolve. I've been watching a lot of Star Trek lately, and it references ideas from ancient Greece, Shakespeare, and even Sherlock Holmes. Important ideas rise to the surface, and each generation will repurpose those ideas in different ways that are meaningful to them. This is why I don't begrudge sequels and remakes, because sometimes they can actually revive a concept that was great, but an execution might seem dated or unappealing to a modern viewer. For example, Tron versus Tron Legacy. I like the original Tron, but I also know it's very niche in its appeal. Westworld, the original movie, is slow and kind of silly, and it's mostly just a chase for 2 hours. It handles things in a way that is too primitive for modern audiences. The opening scene is just some dorky reporter standing in an airport trying to get some passengers returning from Westworld to shed some light on the experience. It's tedious. Just show us Westworld. I think it's much more interesting to see, okay, you dropped into the Wild West. Oh, but wait, this is not what I thought it was. That's way more engaging. But that's as a result of genre and culture evolving so that we do understand these shorthands, that we do become more and more familiar with these more abstract and out there concepts. The HBO series, on the other hand, is breathtakingly beautiful. It rivals or even surpasses the kinds of films made in the 1970s. Well, season one, at least, you know how I feel about where it's gone since then. The writing is fresh and compelling. It is an intricate web of intrigue and conspiracy. It evokes deep ideas of morality and philosophy. It is saying things about AI that are more relevant to our current understanding of the technology. It was, in short, taking the original ideas and reinventing them for the modern age, to be more easily digested by modern audiences. I admire people who have the patience for the classics. I think it is important that someone is preserving these stories and keeping them alive. At the same time, if your only concept of, say, Hamlet is The Lion King or that one episode of The Simpsons, then that's totally valid. It's still broadening your cultural experience, and those stories are still, even in a piecemeal way, living on anew. Perhaps this is why the sequels and prequels for Alien are so controversial. The original still holds up. It's not lacking in any way. Sure, some of the effects are dated now, but it's still effective horror. Most people seem to enjoy Aliens, but every other Alien film after that has had a mixed response at best. Maybe it does come down to, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I do agree with that to some extent. I would much rather movies with great concepts but poor execution get remade than see beloved classics get remade. What is the point? Like, Ghostbusters is perfect. Stop making more Ghostbusters. Just leave it. It's fine. Of course, some things are not literal or direct remakes or sequels. They're more like remixes. So Ridley Scott often talks about Planet of the Vampires being a film that inspired Prometheus, and we do see elements of that work its way into that film. So in that sense, you know, Planet of the Vampires, I tried watching it, it is very slow, it's just not my kind of thing, but someone who loved and appreciated that movie took that and showed me what they loved about it, and made me see it through their eyes. You know, I really admire anyone who has that ability. You know, they're really passionate about something. And, you know, I might not personally be a fan, but they can show me what this thing is through their eyes. Like, I don't care for old Ray Harryhausen movies, but Peter Jackson loves that stuff. And so growing up and seeing all the Lord of the Rings behind the scenes stuff and him talking about that, I saw it through his eyes and understood why it was important. Or same thing with Guillermo del Toro. He loves a lot of very obscure things, a lot of obscure horror specifically that I had never even heard of and I probably will never read or watch, but I understand why it's meaningful because I've seen it through his eyes. Alright, that about covers it. This is Colson signing off. You can find me on TravianDesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook. I would like to thank patrons Mark Boda, Tariq, and William Elkhart. If you would also like to become a patron, head on over to patreon.com/TravianDesigns.